Welcome to At the Organ, a weekly show about the classical organ and its music, heard on organlive.com every Sunday or streaming from our website anytime. Just point your browser to attheorgan.com for more information. Now, let's hear what's happening this week at the organ.
Hello, and thank you for joining me today on At the Organ. My name is Brent Johnson. Last week we heard from Dr. Christopher Marks about his latest release on the Raven label, the third in a series of recordings of the organ music of Seth Bingham. Today we're going to talk about the organ that we heard on all three of those albums, and one that has appeared on many other recordings, the Schoenstein organ of First Plymouth Congregational Church in Lincoln, Nebraska. The organ of First Plymouth is actually two organs, the Ruth Marie Ammon Gallery organ and the lead chancel organ. The distinctive brick church was built in 1930 and includes a 171-foot tall carillon tower. The church's first organ was a Kimball, which served from 1931 until it was removed in 1967. Replacing it was a 71-rank Schlicker organ, which had pipes in the front and in the rear gallery. Anticipating the removal of the Schlicker in 1996, the church commissioned a 15-rank gallery organ from Schoenstein to serve the church while the chancel organ was installed. The completed organ includes 110 ranks. The end result is a pipe organ that is unique, complicated, and overall very beautiful. Without doing too much digging, I can count 18 commercial recordings that have been made on the instrument in less than 20 years. So to find out more about this instrument, how it came to be, and what it's like to play it, I called up a few people who could tell me more about it. First is Jack Bethards, president and tonal director of the Schoenstein Organ Company in Benicia, California, right outside of San Francisco. He tells us about how they came to start work on the first Plymouth organ.
Well, they were concerned about the utility of the instrument they had to cover the very wide-ranging music program that Jack Levick developed for the church. And the organ that they had was really what you might call a repertoire-specific organ. That is designed primarily for the organ solo repertoire. And what they were looking for was something along what we call the symphonic line, a type of instrument that is broad-gauged in its color range and dynamic range so that it could play the widest possible range of not only organ solo repertoire, but accompaniments, transcriptions, and so on. So the whole objective there was to create a symphonic palette of tone. My background is in the orchestral world, and so I always think of the symphony orchestra, the modern symphony orchestra, as probably the most perfect vehicle for musical expression, and instrumental musical expression. And my objective with the organ is to try to make it have those same qualities. The idea, I should point out very clearly, is not to imitate a symphony orchestra. The idea is to do the same musical job that a symphony orchestra can do, that is, a huge range of dynamic levels and a huge range of color tones so that it can make a conductor happy. Well, we start, of course, by analyzing what the needs of the client are. Each organ is, almost all organs today are custom made, and that means you start with a musical objective. It's much like the process that an orchestrator and contractor go through in developing an orchestral instrumentation. You start out by looking at the requirements of the orchestration and then selecting orchestra players to fit the instrumentation required. And that's just about what we do with organs. I, in effect, act as the orchestra contractor in putting together the instruments that are necessary to play the music. after getting a feeling for the overall musical requirements, you have to look at some practical aspects too. What's the size of the building? What's the acoustical quality of the building? What's the size of the space available for the instrument? So you have to put some boundaries on your project. That's the number one, is to have a feeling in general for the scope of the instrument, how large it's going to be. Then the next thing, you go back to the history of organ design, and you must follow a lot of the standard sort of architecture points of organ design. That is the proportions of various tonal families that are required in an instrument. And we start, of course, with the diapason family and distribute the diapason tones throughout the divisions of the instrument. You first of all, of course, have to decide how many divisions the organ's going to have. Is it a three manual, a four manual, and so on. And then design the diapason or principal choruses for each of the divisions. Then you go through all the rest of the tonal families doing the same thing. And I use a system of spreadsheets. These are not computer spreadsheets. I'm talking about hand spreadsheets. And I go through each of the tonal families of the organ and each of the divisions and put them all out on a very large set of spreadsheets so that we can visualize on paper what the different tonal qualities are going to be, and whether we that way avoid duplications and try to spread the amount of variety in a rather meticulous analysis. Designing that organ or any organ is a real partnership with the musicians involved and the organ builder. I mean, you have to be working regularly and closely together, and every decision that gets made gets reviewed and discussed. Often the organist has great ideas that we incorporate into the instrument, and this was certainly true with Jack Levick. Jack Levick is very, very keenly interested in all the details of the organ and everything, and he was constantly involved, constantly interested, asking questions, and a lot of the credit for the design of the organ has to go to him. And it's true in many of our jobs that the organist, if he's really interested in organ tone, makes interesting contributions. So it's a real partnership.
Tell us about some of the unique developments you came up with in designing this organ.
Well, at the time, they were unique. We've now adopted many of them and newer instruments. But the first interesting one for that project would be the Tubin stop. I was at the Chicago on a consulting job and had a chance to go to hear the Chicago Orchestra in their own hall. They played the overture from Tannhäuser, and I heard that trombone section playing that magnificent theme, four trombones in perfect unison, but with that breadth of tone that you only get with multiple instruments playing in unison. Why can't we have that effect on an organ? So in the process of designing the Lincoln organ, I thought, well, we can't afford to put four 8-foot tubas in the organ. That's just going too far. But we could take the tuba chorus of 16, 8, and 4 stops, which we did have planned, and make them play all at unison. So in other words, the 8-foot stop would play normally, the 16-foot stop would play an octave above in unison, and the 4-foot an octave below in unison, and giving you that effect of three similar tones playing together. And that was the idea, and that started on that instrument.
Thank you.
We did the same with clarinets. Another great sound in the orchestra is unison clarinets. Again, we had a 16-foot clarinet and an 8-foot clarinet, but we added a 4-foot clarinet so that we could then provide 3 8-foot clarinet tones in unison. Those are interesting effects that came from that job.
So on those stops, just pulling one draw knob, you bring on all three ranks at one unison pitch?
Exactly, yes. As far as individual tones, I think one of the most interesting, which was not developed there, it was developed one organ earlier, but it's our symphonic flute, or we call it a Böhm flute. This is an interesting stop, again developed from experience with orchestral instruments. The real orchestral traverse flute that you hear all the time in a symphony orchestra has a very interesting quality. It changes in its character greatly from the bottom of its register to the top. That's because no matter what note you play, the tube is always the same diameter. So when the note is very high, great diameter compared to its pitch, and vice versa when you're playing a low tone. So the low tones in a flute are rather reedy and almost stringy in tone, and then as it goes higher and higher, it gets more and more rich in fundamental, powerful flute tone. So I wanted to get that wonderful effect. It's the kind of thing you hear in Debussy, Afternoon of a Faun. You'll hear that beautiful sound when the flute's playing between its low C and its low G sharp or so, and then it soars up into its higher tone quality. I wanted to get that on an organ. We did a tremendous amount of research work. I read, of course, the Böhm treatise on flute design and talked to flute players, talked to flute makers, visited a flute shop and talked at great length about how they go about making flutes. And we started experimenting. We made over 100 pipes using all sorts of things, some of them quite crazy, to see if we could get this effect. If we could make a flute through the entire range of the organ keyboard have these different changing sounds. And we did, finally, after a lot of experimentation. And it requires harmonic pipes, double harmonic pipes, and double mouth harmonic pipes. But the end result is something that sounds a lot like the full family of orchestral flutes, starting at the bass flute on the bottom and going up through alto, regular flute, and piccolo.
And that stop is found in the solo division of the organ. Yeah. Tell us a little more about that division of the organ.
Well, the solo is very important there because they do so much in the way of orchestral transcriptions in their program, and also a lot of very interesting transcribed choir accompaniments. Well, that solo is quite complete. It has a pair of big strings, that is fairly keen but very large strings. It has a bass clarinet and the 8-foot clarinet and 4-foot clarinet, which combine into the three unison clarinets. It has a French horn, and the rest of the solo is the tuba ensemble of 16, 8, and 4. And then very, very delicate, rather angelic sounding stops called the Chorus Seraphique and Voix Angelique. These are highly tapered, soft, what we call hybrid stops. That is, they're stops that are somewhere between the tone of a flute and a string. And then it has also a mixture, but a mixture with a tierce component. So it's a very, very piercing kind of mixture.
And how is a mixture like that used in the chorus of the organ?
It's made particularly to go with the reeds. The big reeds in the solo are the English style, rather full fundamental, rather dark reeds, and so the tierce mixture is a wonderful complement to them. The gallery instrument was always intended to be part of the whole ensemble, but it's a completely independent instrument and was there and served the church as the only organ in the church for over a year while the larger organ was being built. So it's quite a marvelous little organ. It's not too many stops, but it certainly covers the general requirements that they needed for all of their church services for quite a time. Oh boy, that's the most recorded instrument that we have. The building is so perfect. and the setting is quiet. It's just an ideal recording organ. And so we've had just loads of recordings made there. And I think that Chris Marks' recordings are among the favorite of people we send them. You see, we send these recordings out to potential clients and we get feedback. And I'll tell you that his have had wonderful feedback.
You're listening to At the Organ.
We've talked a great deal about the orchestral abilities of this organ, but it is, at its heart, a classical organ that can play organ repertoire from various periods. Tell us about thinking of that design while building a symphonic organ.
Well, as I mentioned, you have to think of the traditional architecture of the organ, and there has been a very clear path of development over the centuries of what's required to take care of the organ solo repertoire of each period. And there are two points to keep in mind. One is that what I call architecture. That is the structure of the choruses with the organ. For example, the diapason chorus is a rather fully developed chorus. And then you have to add to it the other tone families, stop flutes, open flutes, strings, and so on. And it's a fairly well-developed formula that all organ builders know, that there are some basics you have to follow in order to be able to render the solo repertoire. So we start with that pattern and make sure that an instrument is capable of doing that. But the other point is the tonal character. It's really impossible in one instrument to capture the tonal character of each period of organ repertoire. But as long as the architecture is there, and as long as the tones are attractive and blend and work well with one another, you can render the repertoire of each of the major periods of the organ solo repertoire very well. The analogy I like to draw is that when you hear a classical symphony played by a modern symphony orchestra with 18 first violins and maybe 18 seconds and huge viola section, cello section, bass section, well, it's nothing like what the classical orchestra would be. However, it can be a very musical and very attractive and very worthwhile performance. So the objective with an eclectic organ or an organ attempting to play the whole repertoire is not necessarily authentic tonal structure, but an authentic architecture so that you have available the proper general tonal quality at the proper pitch, but not necessarily the specific tonal character of a historic instrument. Tom Trenny is the music director and organist of First Plymouth, and I asked him what it's like to play this instrument every week.
You know, I think one of the great gifts of this organ is how it can play with choir and with singers. So many organs, as you start to add stops, in other words, you're growing kind of the feeling of the sound, you tend to not be able to use a lot of registrations with choir or singers because they're too loud. In this organ, because of so many things are enclosed in the expression boxes, you can take a really significant color of sound and kind of that kind of firefly in the jar excitement in the sound, but keep it dynamically soft so that those colors and that energy can be used in combination with other instruments and singers and so on. So I think that's part of the way it's inordinately valuable to have these expressive possibilities. The way they do that, by the way, is by taking some of the loudest and softest stops in the organ and putting those stops inside an expression box, inside another expression box. So you have two layers of dynamic possibility for the loudest and softest stops. And if you can imagine what that does, it takes the extreme ends of loud and soft and allows them to get louder and softer, right, in either way. So it's very effective in the way it works here.
Well, does that end up creating new technical challenges for an organist?
Well, there are 5 expression pedals on the organ, which is a lot of stuff to keep track of. And, if I may, it does matter. I mean, a lot of organs where you play, you know, if the swell's open or closed, it makes a 2% difference, really, if we're honest. But here, you know, if the solo trumpets are open, you know, you're going to have a solo. And if they're closed, it's going to sound like a faint chorus reed. So it really does matter that you keep track of where the different dynamics are in the relationship between the divisions.
One thing that I've found is that organs, when they're combined with orchestra and you have a professional orchestra conductor, it's common, in fact, almost always, the conductor says, gee, I like that sound, can't you make it softer? Or, I like that volume, but couldn't you change the tone quality? And almost always, the organist has to say, no, I can't do that, I'm stuck. And our idea is to try to eliminate that problem so that the organist can say, yes, I can do that. Same with the choral conductors, they have the same problem. They want a certain sound to accompany the choir and they can't get it. Well, our idea, we want an organ that can get it. And that was what this organ was designed to do. And I think it comes pretty close of being able to do what a creative musician wants to have done.
One of the selling points in having the new organ was, I guess there was some disagreement. Wasn't the old organ loud enough? Why do we have to get a new one? And the pastor started answering that and saying, well, this one's going to actually be able to play a lot softer as well. So, and that's all true. You know, an interesting thing about this instrument, as orchestral and symphonic as it is, you can also play a lot of things here in kind of a quote-unquote normal way. It's very effective in putting on a lot of different kinds of accents, and I think that's a compliment to the organ builders and also in some ways to the space that the organ's in and kind of the volume. I don't mean dynamic volume, but the space in which the organ can sing. You can treat music in an academic way here if you would want to, and you can also give it a very symphonic accent if you choose, and it's nice to have those choices. We have 2 stops in the organ that are on flexible wind. Now, who would imagine in a symphonic orchestral organ that you'd have a cornet and a quintadina that are on flexible wind? I mean, that opens up a whole other world of color and feel. I mean, it's really a privilege and joy to play here.
We learn something every time we build an organ. Every time, there's no doubt. This organ was a wonderful experience, especially working with Jack, who was so interested in exploring new ideas for organ design. That's, I should point out, a really important point, that if the client is interested in having something really special and willing to take some chances and do something unusual, that just opens the way for a wonderful experimentation and excitement in the job. And this one turned out very well, a great deal because of that openness, the interest in really creating something and doing things that were a little bit out of the ordinary. And I think it worked well.
Jack Bethards is president and tonal director of the Schoenstein Organ Company, and Tom Trenny is minister of music and organist at First Plymouth Congregational Church. We tried to reach Jack Levick, who was minister of music at First Plymouth when this organ was built, but I'm afraid he was unavailable. So that's all for our show today. I'll be back with you next week, when we'll continue our conversation with Jack Bethards, talking about the Schoenstein Organ Company. My thanks go to Audio DNA and Bill Bentley Productions for their help in producing both this week and last week's show. The composers and titles and performers for all the music you heard today can be found on our website, attheorgan.com. There you'll also find links to information about our guests, as well as links to purchase this music for yourself. Of course, all the music today was recorded on the Schoenstein organ of First Plymouth and Lincoln, and a link to the specification of the organ can be found on our website as well. While you're there, if you've enjoyed today's show, why not leave a comment on our website? You can talk to us and meet other At the Organ listeners on our Facebook page, and we're on Twitter as well. Links are on our website. Lastly, if you've got something to tell us, you can just email info@attheorgan.com. We'd love to hear from you. My name is Brent Johnson, and I leave you today with Stuart Forster playing a work titled Toccata by Jerry Hancock. Please join me next week at the same time on Organ Live or anytime at theorgan.com.
At the Organ is a production of the Organ Media Foundation. For more information about supporting the foundation or sponsoring an episode of At the Organ, go to organmedia.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll meet you here next week at the Organ.